Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
What are folks going to find when they come here?
Well, I think they're going to find like a new sort of winter wonderland, at least at this time of year. But it's going to be this amazing public space anchored by the vessel, facing this phalanx of buildings that are really redefine the skyline of New York. And then they're going to go into the retail center, and they're going to experience 100 shops, 25 restaurants. It's just everything about it is going to be new and different and bright and animated. And I think from that perspective, it's going to be unlike anything they've experienced in Manhattan.
For people who don't work around here, what's the draw? Why do they want to come here?
Well, I think they want to come here for a lot of reasons. Public transportation to this part of town is actually very, very good now that number 7 subway comes to our front door. So 5 million workers live within a 40-minute commute. So that makes it very easy for a company to relocate here because they know it's going to be convenient for their staff. Chelsea to the south is now one of the hottest markets in Manhattan. The art gallery scene, the success of the High Line, the success of the Whitney Museum. We're going to add to that now with the Shed. The Shed will bring another couple million people here for this unique confluence of performing arts, visual arts, and popular culture, which has really never been done before. So I think people are going to be attracted for all sorts of reasons. It's a combination of wellness in the form of Equinox Hotel and Equinox Club and Flagship Equinox, destination tourist attraction in the form of the Observation Deck, local culture in the case of the Shed, retailing, and all of that will make it a great place to live and work. And so we've got lots of great corporate tenants who represent all the leading industries of New York, and soon we're going to have, a great thriving community of residents.
Some people could describe it as a city within a city. Is that fair, and is that good or bad?
Yeah, I think it's a fair assessment, city within a city. We try to have everything here, Hospital for Special Surgery, Mount Sinai, we got a bike shop, convenient access to Newark Airport. Basically, if we think it's important to city life, we want to try and incorporate it here at Hudson Yards. So it is a city within a city. And I think it's a good thing. What we don't want to have people think is we're not a city that's walled off from the rest of the city. So in that sense, we'd like to think we're very much integral to the city grid. We're integral to the west side of Manhattan, and that we're very porous. People can come and exit from all points of the compass. And so in that sense, we're not a city within a city. We're part of the city, and we're a very vibrant part of it.
Another neighborhood, which is often described as a city within a city, is Battery Park City. How do the two compare?
Well, they're comparable in size a little bit if you take Brookfield Place with the residential development to the south. Where I think we're quite different is that in Battery Park City, the commercial precinct is separate from the residential precinct. And we believe that they should be interwoven with each other so that people come and go 24/7. And similarly, we have a very, very large concentration of retail. And it's one thing to have kind of street-related retail, single story, but that then doesn't have critical mass. So, who wants to be at one end of the street versus the other end of the street? Where when you concentrate it, as we have here, all the retailers want to be together because they know they all support each other. Same goes for the restaurants. So I think that that's a major difference, that we have this really substantial retail presence.
Let's talk retail. Some people say retail is dead. No.
Well, it's not dead at Hudson Yards, that's for sure. If you've been around here all day, you've been down in the retail center watching people scurry to get the stores open. No, I don't think it's dead. I think it's actually changing. We have a number of digital brands that are moving into our retail complex, which it's their first store. But they're already thriving brands as an online presence. So I think that's going to become a trend that we might see more of. We've got small pop-ups. We've got long-established brands. The established brands, I think, are still cognizant of the fact that people want to be able to walk into a store and touch the material. And they know that this is a long-term play. So there's not going to be anything like Hudson Yards retail in Manhattan for hundreds of years because it's so difficult to assemble real estate. And I think it's also fair to say that Manhattan is a unique retail environment by comparison to the rest of the country. We are somewhat under-retailed when you look at the concentration of people that live in Manhattan versus the amount of retail we have as compared to a more suburban model. So we're not overbuilt like the retail industry is in general. I also think it's one of the few places where if you're going to open a store and you could, and you're fussy about where you're going to open a store, you're going to want to open in Manhattan in an ideal, perfect location in Manhattan because you get so much traffic. We're just so dense. So we believe fundamentally that the future retail is vibrant, certainly in Manhattan and especially at Hudson Yards.
But the fact of the matter is there are vacant storefronts all through the city. And if you go to 57th and 5th, which was once the highest priced neighborhood in the country, if not the world, there are vacancies there. What makes this different? Why will this work?
Well, you hit the nail on the head about 57th and 5th, highest priced neighborhood. Our rents are not nowhere near what the rents are in 5th Avenue and Madison Avenue. And I think that what you're seeing in Midtown is just a mispricing of the market. It's not that people don't want to have stores in that location, it's they maybe can't afford the rent. So the rent as a percentage of sales now has got out of whack with what is supportable. I think here we found that, you know, we're not necessarily getting the rents we had hoped to get, but we are certainly getting the interest that we had hoped to get. And so people want to be here, and we structured deals that work for them and work for us, and that's why we're going to open 85% leased in this environment.
But when people can buy whatever they want in their pajamas, in their living room, on their computers, is retail a draw? Is it bringing me to Hudson Yards?
Well, I think it depends on the retail. I mean, certain, you know, staples you can buy online easily. But if you really want to go and try on three or four jackets, you can't do that online. And if it's, you know, it's going to be a big investment for you, you want to make sure you got it right. And if at the same time you want to go and shop with friends or family, can't do that online. And oh, by the way, when you can shop with friends and family, in, at least in Hudson Yards, you'll be able to get together for a drink or go for brunch or have a bite to eat at dinner. And so the whole social dynamic changes considerably. It's not simply, can I buy that online or can I buy it here? It's like going to the movies. You can watch anything you want, Netflix, but people still go to the movies and people still go to shop because it's actually part of civil social society. And I think that's what's going to happen. That's why people come. And that's what we've tried to do is create something here that it's so lively, it's so energetic, it's so dynamic, and it's so varied. Like, no matter what you want to do today, let's go to Hudson Yards. Like, we'll find something to do that's fun.
You have the first Neiman Marcus in the city. Mm-hmm. Is that a big deal?
It's a very big deal. Neiman's have not been in the city for years because they own Bergdorf Goodman. And so oftentimes it was always considered that they wouldn't come into the city because they didn't want to compete with Bergdorf's. And I think what we're seeing here again is the sort of the way in which Hudson Yards and the West Side is starting to distinguish itself from Midtown. So I think people see Neiman's coming to the West Side as a very young and vibrant and exciting thing. Neiman's is finally coming to Manhattan. That's fantastic. That's not to say we don't love Bergdorf's, but Bergdorf's is a, you know, a different brand in a different part of town. And so we believe there's more than enough room for both brands.
Let's move to the Public Gardens. What is it about that that you think will attract people? And what's the significance of Vessel?
So when we started to design the Public Gardens, we have, as part of the zoning, a 5-acre open space to design. And we really were conscious of the fact that it had to be a great public space like Central Park or Bryant Park that people liked to go to and they just naturally went there when they had spare time. And when we looked around at 20th century public space, it was hard to find good examples of spaces designed in the 20th century that were real crowd favorites. So we started to look around at other examples which were had worked well so well in the past. And the idea was to look at sort of a European palazzo concept, which the paving pattern became important, the way in which the soft landscape worked with the hard landscape, the intimacy became important because there's a big building surrounding space. We thought it was going to be very important, and when you're up in the buildings looking down on the plaza, that it look attractive. So that led us to a kind of intricate paving pattern. And the paving pattern allowed us to kind of link all the buildings together and organize them toward a central space. So then you've got this kind of hub and spoke condition where the hub is the middle of the public space and the buildings are the spokes. What do you do in the hub? It became important, it was sort of obvious that we needed to have a marker there. We needed to have something that was the rallying cry for everything around, be it a flagpole or a tower or something. And that led us to the search for a monumental piece of art. And we thought if the artwork was monumental enough, then it in itself would be the destination. And then once you say, I'll meet you at the vessel, then what are we going to do? Well, let's go have a drink. Let's go shopping. Look, I'm going to go to Equinox. I want to take a play at the Shed tonight. That, the whole idea was to sort of have this monumental marker. So we spent a lot of time looking all over the world for artists and speaking to anybody and everybody who would give us the time of day. And in the end, we found Thomas Heatherwick, and we were persuaded by his originality and the idea that he wanted Vessel to be completely interactive with the public, but really simple. So the idea that you have this simple, interlaced structure of just stairs and platforms, which allow people to do whatever they want, within reason, and lots of variety, and I think lots of activities, and we hope someday to program the vessel as people begin to use it, and they'll come to us with programming. We already had one guy come to us as a result of the New Yorker piece saying, I want to have music on the vessel. And so I think we're going to find any and all kinds of activities that people are going to bring to us, including the name. The vessel is just a holding pattern. And I think that, too, is all about animating the public space. So we're extremely excited about the potential of our vessel. It's unlike anything anywhere.
So you say public art, and people are going to look at this thing, and they're going to say, what is it? What is it?
And I'm going to say it's whatever you make it out to be, yeah.
So it's public art, it's observation deck, it's exercise equipment,
yeah,
I mean, all of the above.
Yeah, it's performance space, it's an observation deck, it's a perch, it's a quiet space. You get five levels up and around one point and no one's there and you've got a platform all to yourself. You might want to go up there to propose marriage. Who knows what you're going to do? When the sun goes down, it's going to be spectacular. I think when the sun comes up, there's going to be exercise on the vessel. There might be yoga on the vessel. I mean, I have cocktail hour on the vessel. I don't know. I mean, that's the point, is that it's so simple, and yet it has so much potential that it really makes it a public gift and really makes it accessible.
And in terms of the gardens, I don't know if I'm going to phrase this the right way, but are you concerned that this becomes a plaza like your World Trade Center where people eat their lunch and then they move on and that's it?
No, we don't think so, because we were careful right from the beginning that we knew we needed a certain amount of hard landscape as a place, a gathering place, but we really wanted to introduce as much landscaping as possible. And so it's called a public space and gardens for a reason. There are lots of gardens. There are boss of trees, and again, using the European examples, under the boss will be tables and chairs, and the idea is that people linger for lots of different reasons. The lighting's going to be spectacular. We'll be really seriously concerned about the horticulture. And so again, I think that the combination of soft, excellent, high-quality landscaping and lighting, gardens and plaza is going to make it attractive. And I think a good analog is the is Columbus Circle, where both the soft landscaping and the hard landscaping work very, very well. And there you are in the edge of Central Park, of all places, and nevertheless, the Columbus Circle is always animated. People like to sit, like the fountains. They like, it's peace. It's as peacefulness within, the maelstrom that is New York.
The city is constantly evolving. The skyline is constantly evolving. What do these buildings do for the skyline, and how important was it to really contribute to the evolving skyline?
I think it was very important to contribute to the skyline, and it's exciting to see what used to be a valley in the New York skyline to become a peak. And so we took that really seriously because I think the New York skyline is, you know, kind of a public trust. And so early on, you know, we had a normal rectilinear office tower designs. And Stephen Ross, our chairman, said, you know, they look too ordinary. And then one day he posed the question. He said, what do you think is the most significant building on the New York skyline? And when you pose it that way, like skyline, you know, my answer was the Citicorp building. And he said, you're right. Because it was angular, it was different. And so I think that was kind of a little of an inspiration to create a skyline that was so unique that it had sort of its own signature. And working with Bill Pedersen at KPF, I think the first two towers were designed to be sort of a brother and sister, or as he likes to say, Fred and Ginger, on the skyline. And I think that, you know, they work with each other. And the other aspect that's interesting about both buildings is that they have an inclined face. And when you have an inclined face, it reflects the light very, very differently. So when it's an all-gray day and every building in New York looks gray, those buildings that have a slight incline are sparkling. It's both the corners of one World Trade and our buildings sort of stand out because they've got that incline. So I think that helps a lot as well. So it gives it, again, another aspect of uniqueness. And then when we went into David Child's building and Liz Diller and David Rockwell's building, you know, we said, okay, we started that. This is our signature now. We want unique skyline buildings. And so the sort of clover leaf of Liz and David's building is very interesting. The kind of whirling dervish of David Child's building where the corners kind of spin off as you go up. All were designed to try and create variety at the skyline level.
So this is the Hudson Yards. The project is built over the rail yards. Just give us a sense what it took to get here, building the platforms and what was involved.
Well, I think, you know, building the platform in some ways is an engineering marvel. In other ways, it's sort of simple. But I think what when it complicated was you had to build a platform while the trains continued to run. So there's 30 tracks, and so you could never have more than four tracks shut down at a time. And so swinging steel, drilling caissons, all became this kind of open heart surgery where we were able to, and it's like, it's not so much you're building a table on which you sit the buildings, you're building a table that has 200 legs, which are the caissons. And the legs all have to go down between the tracks. And so they have to go wherever the tracks allow them to go. And it may not be where you want them to go for the purposes of the building above. So there was a lot of structural gymnastics that had to take place between the trains and the lower floors of the buildings. And so the buildings are, in some cases, I wouldn't say over-engineered, but I mean are really engineering marvels because of the way in which they're founded. On the bedrock below. So they're founded on bedrock, but trains run through the foundations. So I think we were lucky in the sense that it all sort of went off without a hitch, believe it or not. And so we went vertical right on schedule. And so that was a big, big challenge. And then once we got going vertical, the next challenge was how do you get glass to keep up with structure? And that's why we formed our own curtain wall factory in Pennsylvania to ensure supply. So that when we got to the top of the building, the glass wasn't very far behind. And then that allows you to start the mechanical. So the scheduling and the logistics of scheduling became hugely important along the way. In some ways, the most important.
You're opening the public gardens. You're opening the retail. What is the time frame for the other buildings on the site?
Right. Good question. So we're opening the retail, public gardens, and Vessel next week. 15 Hudson Yards is essentially open, just waiting for the gardens, which are its front door, to open. 30 Hudson Yards will open in the next, well, the official opening the first week of April. Warner Media are starting to move in next week. 55 Hudson Yards, which is just behind the number 7 subway, is already open, and I would say probably 30 to 40% occupied by its tenants now, and it'll be filling up throughout the summer. 35 Hudson Yards, which is the home of Equinox head office, flagship Equinox Club, SoulCycle Club, and the first Equinox Hotel, will also go on sale from the condo perspective next week, and it will open officially in June, and so I think office tenants like Equinox will move in July, And so we anticipate all the buildings will be officially open by June, and I would say all the buildings will be occupied by the end of the year.
And what is the residential here? These are mostly office towers, right?
There's three office towers and a fourth one under construction, which will be the home for BlackRock. And then there are two residential towers. And between the two residential towers, we have 400 condominiums.
What's the timeline on the Western Yards, and how soon will that start, and how long will it take to complete?
Well, the answer to both questions is a bit of a guess, but we anticipate starting about a year from now. So there's six different sites in the Western Yards, and we've retained the six architects. We've designed the platform that go over the yards, obviously learning from the first platform. We're finalizing agreement with the Long Island Railroad on the design of that platform. And so we would think to be in a good position to start about a year from now. Then how fast we build out those sites will be determined to some degree by market conditions. We have one more commercial office site on Western Yards, and the rest are residential. We have a public school. One site is complicated by the fact that the gateway tunnel cuts across the site, so we've got to build a box for Amtrak below the building. So that will take some time. So it's hard to say, but I would say, I think on average we anticipate that we start a year from now and we finish 10 years from now.
I want to just ask you about the observation deck. What can you tell us about that? What's that going to be like?
Well, the observation deck will open by the end of the year. It's the tallest outdoor observation deck in the Western Hemisphere, so it's taller than even the Empire State Building observation deck. It also has an event space up there and a lounge, so it's a really double level. It's unlike any observation deck anywhere because it cantilevers off the building, so you're 60 feet away from the building, sort of standing in midair. It's got a set of bleachers.
Sounds kind of scary.
It's kind of scary, but you can do the non-scary route if you want. We were just up there this afternoon. It's got a glass floor. You look down 1,000 feet beneath your feet.
What is that like?
We did it today for the first time, and it took a little getting used to, and then you calm down after a while. And then we have a set of bleachers that link one level to the other, and when you go up on the bleachers, now you're sort of looking out even over the glass balustrade, and so you really do feel like you're floating in space, and you can just reach out and touch Midtown with your hand, or the World Trade Center, or the Statue of Liberty. It's an astonishing feeling, and you look. You see the Hudson River, the East River, you see Coney Island, you see, you know, all the way up to Sandy Hook. It's extraordinary.
You know, I want to ask you, some of the things you've referenced, Central Park, Rockefeller Center, Bryant Park, is this site off the beaten path?
Well, it would have been considered off the beaten path years ago. Now we think it's an addition to the beaten path. So I think when people think of New York in the future, they're going to think of all those places, including Hudson Yards.
How does the High Line fit into this whole thing?
And the High Line's a huge component for us because its success, I think, really is a harbinger of what we expect to come. You know, they're now doing close to 8 million people a year in the High Line, and so two-thirds of the High Line are below us running from Gansevoort up to 10 Hudson Yards where we're sitting, and then the last third of the High Line wraps our site, so heads west to the river, wraps around the Western Yards, phase two, and comes back and finishes by 55 Hudson Yards. So we've got a very symbiotic relationship with them. There's a major on-off point in between 10 Hudson Yards and the shed is where we come on and off the High Line. We're working with them. The last piece called a spur, which goes underneath 10 Hudson Yards on its way to 10th Avenue, is hopefully within a month of being completed as well. So by the time summer comes around, the whole intersection of the High Line, Hudson Yards, the shed, 10 is going to be fantastic.
So I know for years you worked very hard to try to get a Jets football stadium built here. How do you think a football stadium would look here?
Still work just fine, actually. It'd be phase two. So stay tuned.
When you look at what you have now and you think about what you fought for then, what is your sense?
Well, I think what we were fighting for then and what we've built now is more or less the same thing. Let's revitalize New York. Let's provide new office space. That everything we're building today is entirely consistent with the 2005 Olympic plan. So the rezoning, the way in which we're treating the Eastern Yards, it was all as envisioned. And so I think, we were sort of pushing for the same thing then and we are now. Like, let's grow New York, let's build new. I think people love new. and make the new great. And that's what we're going to do.
Jay, thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.